Welcome to Roguecast, the official podcast of Rogues Gallery. We'll talk comics for the week, as well as whatever news is on our pop cultural radar. I'm Randy.
I'm Nick.
This is Dave.
And now, on with the show.
Episode 3 to 9 of the Roguecast, recorded October 11th, 2022. Into the Flammiverse.
All right, we are into second week of October. Spooky season again.
Yep. I think we're gonna touch on some spooky stuff like the Midnight Club and some other things when we get to the end.
I watched Hellraiser, but neither of y'all have yet. Going to? I don't know.
I'm probably going to. I don't think that's Kaylee's cup of tea, so I'm going to have to watch it on my
own. Kaylee doesn't like torture demons?
Yeah, that's not really her thing.
That is my thing? Yep. No. I've actually only ever seen the first one, and I actually think it was fairly ingenious. It was definitely something like that had not been done before.
Yeah.
And I have some curiosity about this one, enough to maybe catch it, but it's kind of low enough on my priority list that should you want to talk about it, I don't think I even need to leave the room.
Well, I'll
unless you're like, what an ingenious reimagining it is.
I also really like puzzle boxes, so.
I am not that. Without offering up much spoilers, I thought it was okay.
That sounds about like what I would expect.
But I'm going to wait to see if Nick watched it next week, and then we'll talk about maybe next
cool.
week.
Cool. Sometimes you hear early hype, and the early hype was very strong
on
that.
The early hype was strong.
You know what it seems like, Randy? It kind of reminds me of how people were like, Top Gun Maverick is transcendent. It's better than the original, and somehow is like the greatest summer movie of all time.
People are still saying that.
And not derivative. And I watch it, I'm like,
it was
this
Top
has
Gun.
Every single beat from Top Gun, from singing in a bar to will somebody forgive me over the death of somebody that I might have caused. And I was like, I liked it.
Oh, the same
it
death.
Was fun.
But please don't try and tell me it's real innovative.
Yeah, well, it was like the meme of like, you will never understand Cthulhu. It's such a strange squid guy. Yeah, I got it. That's what Top Gun Maverick was. It's like, you can't believe what this movie does. I'm like, it's Top Gun, but modern. He's older now.
Right.
Like, I'd like Top Gun Maverick.
Right. They tweaked the formula just slightly.
I even
got
might
it.
Say it was better than it had a right to be.
I would not say it's better than the original, though.
That's true.
That's probably true.
That's true. The energy of the original can't be redone, and even though there's also some cringe stuff in it now.
There is, but also I think that's the context of it. Like, in the context of the times, Top Gun works. Top Gun Maverick has to work in a time when we should know better than some of the jingoism stuff that's in there.
But also volleyball.
That's true.
Volleyball scene is way better than football scene.
That is true.
It's true. It's so true I don't even really quite remember it.
There was a football beach scene.
I remember vaguely.
Yeah. Anyway. Yeah. We all have a Top Gun Maverick tangent.
Yeah.
But the point is Squid Guy.
Point is Squid Guy.
Anyway.
The point is we may or may not talk about Hellraiser. It's going to be an exciting game. Go ahead and place your bets.
Yeah.
If you want to start a small wager with your friends.
Yes.
We'll find out in about an hour.
Yes. Get a puzzle box and y'all start turning things and see what happens.
What do we got? Let's talk some news or whatever.
The store news. Yes. The big store news is you can text us now.
Yes, that's right. We technology has evolved. We think this is going to help y'all. Help us. Nobody likes to talk to people on the phone
anymore.
Nobody
wants to talk to the phone.
We don't want to talk to you.
No. We like you people plenty. We don't want to talk to you on the phone.
All right, send us a text, please.
Text us. You don't want to talk to us either. Guys,
I think we may get back a little bit quicker and
people are going to send us TikToks.
It's fine. I'll do what I do with all TikToks.
Yeah. Yeah, Randy gets TikToks from close friends and family, and it's just, bye-bye.
No, that's not true. I send a laugh react as if I watched it. God, I hope people aren't sending me TikToks as things serious, because I just assume they're sending me goofy TikToks. Why'd you laugh react the TikTok of my
I've discovered
funeral?
An entirely new philosophy of life. Please watch this. It explains it.
Lol.
10 out of 10. Would watch again. anyway, so yes, same
store
number. Store
phone number? 512.
Right.
279-8888.
You can call us.
You can.
We'll still pick up the phone.
I guess. I mean, do you want to be a dinosaur using old technologies? No. Right. Text us.
Or do you want to be a future kid, like an 80s kid with a Nintendo Power Glove?
Yeah.
Hated that.
Anyways, text us now.
Right. Got it.
We also have a couple Halloween events coming up. We have our Halloween party, which we just put our information up about on Facebook. It's going to be on the website later today.
It's on the 26th.
Yes, that's Wednesday.
It's a new comic book day. So you could swing by right after when the store would normally close at 7, that's when we will have some fun.
It will turn spooky.
It will turn spooky. There's going to be a sale.
There'll be a sale.
There's going to be we're inviting people to dress in costume,
yep.
And we're having a cosplayer who goes by the name of Lucky Lemon out,
yep.
And she's going to sort of be our mistress of ceremonies, mm-hmm. And she's going to help us judge the contest. We're going to give
a cosplay Q&A.
Yep, she's going to talk Q&A with the folks there, and just how she got into it, and also like I'm sure lots of people out there just looking for some ideas on how to get into it themselves.
But also, Dave, there will be the world premiere of her.
She has her own sort of little spooky little YouTube trivia show called Your Life is in Jeopardy. Mm-hmm. And it's, if you want to think of it as Morticia Adams or Elvira hosting a little sort of nerdy trivia thing from a dungeon, from a dark dungeon, sure. In a dark castle.
Yep.
That's the vibe of it. I might be in the first episode.
All right. And we're going to show them on the store TVs.
Yeah, it's going to be fun. It's just like a little 10-minute thing. I'm looking forward to it. I have not seen it.
Oh.
I don't know quite what it looks like, how it's done. This is essentially done over the phone. So it's an audio thing on my end with cool production-y things, I believe, added afterwards.
Nice.
So yeah. But I've seen... So, and we're going to post some like promo shots of her in character from it in the next week or two, just so people can kind of catch its vibe.
Yep. So that is a couple weeks from now. It's Wednesday the 26th.
Yes.
And then on Halloween Day, which is a Monday the 31st, we will be handing out free comics and candy.
Yeah. Our
Serena will be here from 4 to 6, and she will have like extra special stuff. She's going to have like surprises and stuff.
Hmm. Serena is a very, very kind and considerate person. I don't know how she ended up working here.
I don't either.
But she's been very thoughtful over in her time here towards customers. Among other things, she has provided bookmarks to give away.
And stickers for kids.
This is not something we asked of her. This is something she does that on her own that is very cool. And if you get a chance, tell her how cool she is for it.
Yes.
But
we don't do anything for you people.
Hey, I build robots and toy displays.
Nick builds robots and toys. Dave and I do nothing.
I didn't know you were going to go fishing for compliments.
He just said that no one else does anything.
He might have been being sarcastic. but the point is to compliment Serena.
Yes,
at this
course.
Moment, and she's going to be coming out for little as we get closer to close on the actual Halloween day itself. If you got some kids out already dressed up for trick or treating, want to swing by, grab a few comics, get some goodies here.
I've been calling it Halloween pre-gaming.
Oh, I like it. Let's do it. What else we got?
Okay, so this week we got in some Marvel novels.
Yeah.
There's a few different ones. It's from it's the company that does like Asmodee. They're a game company,
right?
But they have some novels, and we noticed that we'd been doing okay with some of the older novels, like the Marvel, the Venom Factor, and the X-Men Spider-Man.
I mean, they used to do these years ago. I mean, Peter David wrote a couple.
Some of these are reissues of those. The original, like the ones not the newest ones, but some of those ones were. And we've also had some success with like the DC ones that mm-hmm. sometimes adapt famous stories like Mad Love, and sometimes are original properties. But no surprise, comic readers like prose just as well. Yep. And
these new ones look fun.
So we're trying out some new
like,
ones.
Rebels of Vanaheim, which is like an Asgardian thing. I forget the exact pitch.
I remember, Randy, when you were reading off the premise for a few of these, we're like, oh, there's some books. Oh, there's actually a number of these books. And like every time you read a premise, I was like, that's a good hook.
Yeah.
Oh, that's a good hook, too.
Yeah, there's a Black Cat heist novel. There's a School of X, which is an anthology set in the X-Men school.
These are all good concepts.
They're very cool. So check those out. They're in the Marvel graphic novel section. There's a whole novel section now. We got the Star Wars Clone Wars Pandemic.
Yeah, this looks awesome.
It looks super cool.
Which is weird, and it is one of those that, like, what's the Cthulhu one?
Cthulhu, Pandemic Cthulhu?
Is it just called Pandemic
Cthulhu?
That one's out of print. Where, it uses the kind of conceptual mechanics of it, but in no way is actually about a pandemic like those.
No, it's
Cthulhu one used the way the virus is spread to show the cultists spreading through a small town, summoning creatures, Shoggoths, and things like that.
The World of Warcraft one.
Yeah, there's a World of Warcraft one.
There's a Fall of Rome one, yeah.
And so they've taken that concept and they've mapped it onto sort of the Star Wars prequel era, where you've got these the Separatists and the battle droids spreading cancerously through the galaxy.
And you and your Jedi and their clone troopers have to go out and stop the spread. And there's different villains.
Yeah.
That you'll deal with a different villain each time.
General Grievous. Who's the...
Asajj Ventress.
Asajj Ventress is one of the big ones.
Count Dooku.
Yep.
There's also...
A especially people I think who've watched the Clone Wars cartoon.
Yeah.
This is you know, has a lot of imagery and troops from it. Bad Batch.
Well, they're full
and
on
stuff like that.
Yeah, Bad Batch, Sakaar. There's full on like episodes, like I think an episode story that you have to. Like,
all
you
the
have
planets
to deal with.
On the board are planets from the show.
From the show. Yeah.
And there's like like you'll recognize like. Although this broadly works, you know, like the same way I think like as Pandemic, where, you know, sort of contain and eradicate is sort of the overall theme is to do. But along the way, there's like, they have like, you know, missions and things like that. So they've definitely tweaked the formula enough to make it feel Star Wars. And it looks really cool.
Also, it comes with really cool miniatures of the Jedi, of the villains, and
little
battle droids that are basically the disease cubes.
Yep.
And if you buy it now, I think we have three left, maybe two left.
Yeah.
You get an extra set of like different colored battle droids. You get basically double the battle droids.
For anyone who ever didn't like those little Roger droids, thinking of them as spreading disease is a perfect metaphor.
It is. I hate the Roger droids, but I like the way they look.
But I like junking them.
Yeah.
The clankers.
We got a couple party games. We got one called Fun Facts, which I didn't look too deep into, and Left Right Dilemma, where you're like as a group cooperatively following this like chain of events and making choices and like following it through, which is a lot of fun. We also got a restock today and some new stuff from Foam Brain, our dice company. So we got a bigger restock on Pride Dice, plastic Pride Dice.
Yep.
We got new Dragon Pride pins, so dragons that have the different colors, different pride flags. We got pronoun pins for she, her, and they, them.
Right.
And then we got stock. We restocked all our pins and stuff, so.
Yeah, that's always exciting when that happens, honestly.
And, okay, I'm going to move on to news.
Yes.
The first thing is, I do a TV podcast, The TV Dudes, with my friends Les Weiler and Nick Moore.
Yep, you've been doing this for a while. Y'all know what you're doing.
Doing it for a while. Nick and Les have a side project they just started kickstarting called Henchin, H-E-N-C-H-I-N. You can
like living the life of a henchman, as in I'm henchin.
Yep. you can back it now. You can go over and check it out. Basically, it's going to be an online. It's going to be a digital web series. I believe there's going to be music and maybe like a physical release or something at some point. But basically, they're going to make a series that is about the henchmen, the blue collar workers that help the villains in superhero worlds.
That sounds like fun. Yep. I'm going to get something of a workplace comedy, but if you were a henchman.
Yep.
Yeah. And I know Les to be a super smart and creative guy. So, check it out.
And then we've got Five Nights at Freddy's. The Five Nights at Freddy's movie has been set at Blumhouse.
Oh, that's interesting. Blumhouse, huh?
The director is someone, it's actually, I didn't know she's a female director or she did something I didn't recognize.
Okay.
But
Five Nights at Freddy's, like, you know, they put out some graphic novels from Scholastic. There's probably, four or five of them. And every once in a while I was like, you know, they missed the boat. The big thing for Five Nights at Freddy's was like 5 or 6 years ago or something like that. But it seems like one of these properties that's going to, there's been enough, I guess, sequels, kind of endure, I think.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to, I think, for at least for a while yet, be a fun, cool kids' first scary outing kind of thing.
Right. Yeah.
Just for those who don't happen to know it or haven't had, if you don't have kids or you haven't heard your friends who are parents talk about, should my kids be playing this? It's a video game that's like a spooky Chuck E. Cheese thing. Imagine the animatronics coming to life at night, roaming around and being scary. That's the hook. Lots of jump scares, I believe.
Probably, yeah.
But I've also heard occasionally that it has kind of a neat lore and stuff behind it. So a movie actually seems like, you know, a good idea. I always like the idea of scary movies that are walk that line between being kind of all ages stuff, like Something Wicked This Way Comes or Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark, you know, anything that's like a good child's, like 10-year-old's first scary movie.
Didn't think Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark was a little darker than that?
Yeah, if you're a wuss, sure. Yeah, but like you know that like people who were reading those books originally probably were as young as like 7 or 8.
Oh yeah.
So yeah, it's in that ballpark. Okay. It is scary for sure. Scarier than most, or than some of that style. But I don't know where the Five Nights at Freddy's will land. I've never played those games, but I feel like the basic concept is sound.
Now we have three trailers to discuss, all of them weird in some way.
Okay.
Let's start with Violent Night.
Yes.
The David Harbour as action Santa Claus.
Yes,
and if that sentence catches your interest, I'd suggest maybe not watching the trailer.
I'm sorry I watched the trailer because it gives away too much, I think.
But I think when we say that, you're sorry you watched it because it's a very fun trailer.
It is super fun trailer.
It is like Die Hard in a North Pole kind of thing.
Yep.
With David Harbour knocking out one-liners and kicking ass, taking like the star off the top of a Christmas tree and gouging it, a terrorist eye out. That bad guys are led by John Leguizamo, and looking like he's having a great time hamming it up.
This is one of those things that like,
and there's a little girl who, by the way, seems like she's the equivalent of who's the cop in the original?
Al.
She's like the owl, I think, who's going to help him out a little bit.
I feel like this is one of those things where you hear the concept, you're like, well, this sounds dumb.
Yeah.
But then you watch the trailer, it looks amazing. But again, having watched the trailer, I'm like, oh, I kind of feel like I know more than I want to know about this now.
It does seem to be one of those that shows the whole movie a little bit. When it comes to Christmas stuff, I very much like the sort of more sincere outings. And I don't even like, Scrooged is the example. Yeah. I like A Christmas Carol and its many incarnations. Yeah. I like Scrooged is a very good movie.
Yes, it is.
But I just don't have like a love for it the way I do the stuff that's set in the era when it was written.
You're a weird traditionalist.
I'm a weird traditionalist on it. And
you don't like Christmas Vacation either.
No, not really. I like the kind of upbeat, optimistic stuff, I guess. That said, I enjoyed this trailer quite a bit.
You liked Anne of the Apocalypse?
That's true. I guess stuff can get past my radar. And
only
I did
musical
like
zombie movies.
I did like Scrooged, though, when I saw it. But do I revisit it? No. Will I revisit Anne and the Apocalypse? Yes. And by the way, people should check out Anne and the Apocalypse.
I believe
a great Halloween Christmas musical.
Anna and the Apocalypse is on my rewatch list now, along with Scrooged and Elf and other stuff like that.
Weirdly, although it itself is somewhat downbeat at times, though always with catchy songs. I do think of it as being somewhat more of a Christmas movie than it is a Halloween movie.
It is. It's more of a Christmas movie, for sure.
Although there's enough zombie stuff in it that you could probably watch it for. Anyway, what are we talking about?
Next, we were talking about the Super Mario Brothers movie trailer.
Yes. Right. It's like CG from a CG movie that is not from like Pixar. Or what, Dreamwave or
it's
whatever?
Illumination. It's the guys who do Desperate, no.
Minions.
Minions and,
okay.
Despicable Me.
Yeah.
Yep. And I guess it's kind of got something of that sense of humor. This is clearly a teaser type trailer, but very high quality animation for it. Mm-hmm. So it's the focus on the bad guy. Bowser and his big troops move in on they land their airship sort of thing, very scarily around like an ice castle where little penguin men, who I don't know from the Mario games, but since Mario does have a penguin suit at some point, I'm going to guess maybe that's a gift that they give him.
They could be akin to the ice climbers. I don't know.
They could. And these little penguins come out and they deliver a very stiff upper lip British type assault of snowballs on Bowser's troops, which does nothing.
Yep.
And Bowser just wrecks the hell out of their castle.
Yep.
That's Bowser voiced by Jack Black, by the way.
Yeah. And not just Jack, like, he's doing a Bowser voice. It sounds like, well,
if you hadn't told me, I might have missed it, but like there's one or two things he says and I'm like, oh yeah, okay, that's Jack Black. And even slightly his facial mannerisms.
Yeah.
And only then when he's like kind of cackling with his evil, he's like, who can stop me now? Do we jump to I guess plumber plucked from the real world ish.
I don't know.
But dropped into the Mushroom Kingdom. It does look like Mario has fallen through a portal where he is acclimating and meets Toad.
Yep.
And sets off to have his mushroom adventure.
Yep.
If you know what I mean.
I do.
Big time psychedelics. That's when the music from Cream kicks in.
Yeah.
And no. Everything else prior to that, though, is exactly the case.
Mario, voiced by Chris Pratt. Toad, voiced by Keegan-Michael Key.
Yep.
I guess Anya Taylor-Joy is Princess Peach. This is like an all-star voice cast, which is a little weird.
Yep. Just to have watched my friends in the internet react to it, I believe the consensus was, oh, this looks way better than I thought. Oh, we don't like Chris Pratt.
Yeah.
I thought Chris Pratt was actually seemed good as Mario. I neither wanted a, I guess I'd say, realistic Italian accent, because the games have never had that.
Nope.
Nor did I want the voice from the games, because he always sounded kind of like a eunuch in that. He's like, let's go! and they need somebody who has, like, can deliver lines that have to, for an animated thing, it's going to have a little more nuance.
We also,
at some point, he's got to have a scene that makes you kind of want to cry.
We also glimpse the better Mario brother.
Toad, are you okay? Toad! Like that.
Yeah.
We also glimpse at the very end the better brother.
That's true.
Which is Luigi.
Luigi, played the Ghostbuster.
Voiced by Charlie Day.
Charlie Day getting attacked by, looked like...
Skeletal Koopas or whatever, yeah.
Which looked awesome. That's the story I want. I don't care about Mario. I only care about Luigi.
Listen, it's a team. They may have their differences, but in the end, they're brothers who stand beside each other. They're not just brothers, Nick. Super Mario Brothers. So don't dismiss one.
Are we going to get Yoshi? Yoshi was...
That's a sequel thing. That's a sequel thing. You go to Yoshi's Island in the sequel. That's a cool setting.
Yeah, I guess. The animation on this looks
actually
cool.
Yoshi should be a prequel, because the Yoshi's Island, at least the original game, was a prequel about him saving little baby Mario.
Look at Dave dropping Mario knowledge.
Yeah, that's true. Although that then doesn't fit in with the weird him being plucked from the real world thing, does it?
No. Mm.
We'll see if they can fix this canon error.
Where did you get the real world from? I thought he just dropped into the Mushroom Kingdom via whatever.
He seemed kind of like... He seemed perplexed by the mushrooms. Toad said, don't touch that or whatever. And he's like... And then he's like, oh, no, wait, that's just a regular mushroom. It's okay. So it's like he was certainly talking to him as if he had just arrived from, if not the real world, some, like, what would maybe be like a town that doesn't look like the Mushroom Kingdom. That's my inference.
Okay.
And I don't think it's a crazy one. And then he says, he's like, Mushroom Kingdom, here we come. Like, again, as if he has never been there.
Okay.
All right.
And then the music from Cream kicks in, and it's like, do, 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 do.
The last trailer is somehow the weirdest of all the trailers, and weirder than the two we've just talked about. It is Megan, M3GAN.
Yep.
That is to say, the E is a 3 in it, like yep. Elite speaking yep. hacker.
It is a movie from James Wan and from the writer of Malignant. That should tell yep. you a lot.
Yep.
It is definitely more in the Malignant than the Conjuring vibe, I believe.
Yep. Although yeah. not the specific thing that Malignant did.
No.
But it does appear to be over the top horror. In fact, the kind of horror where you might be invited to kind of laugh at the insanity of it.
I definitely laughed several times during this trailer.
I feel like this is Child's Play by James Wan.
Absolutely.
And that kind of interests me very much.
Robot girl.
Yes. But that looks like one of those things where it's like, you can almost just, the same way Chucky, like now we see Chucky and we think spooky, evil. But that is very close to how the My Buddy dolls of the era actually looked.
Yep.
And this looks almost like it could be like a, you know, like a little, 3 foot tall. It looked like almost like a slightly like Victorian girl or something that. You know, that's meant to be a companion for a child. Yeah. And
maybe the imprint was too strong because...
Right? At first things seem okay.
Yeah.
But no, then there's...
From the second they introduced that child, we were all like, we know something's happening.
Well, because the face had that an intentional Uncanny Valley look. But the mom, of course, is just, you know, like, it's playing with her and stuff like that. But then they're having dinner at some point, and she kind of... Oh, I know. The doll says some fact that the mom is like, oh, that's inconvenient too. I'm trying to get my daughter to eat her vegetables or whatever.
Yep, yep.
And she's like, okay, Megan, shut down. And then Megan's like turns, not shutting down, and she's like, oh, I thought we were having a conversation.
Did, did you recognize the person
voice?
Who invented the doll?
No.
This is the from Get Out. It was the girlfriend.
Okay, that makes sense. She looked familiar.
Oh, the... Yeah. The girlfriend Get Out. Yeah, I don't want to say anything about that. But right, yeah, that's interesting.
This trailer was hilarious, and there's no way I'm watching this movie.
Because you think it looks dumb?
Because I think it looks dumb. I watched Malignant, and I hated it, so...
This looks fun to me. This looks like kind of like... I'm not going to say Sam Raimi manic. It's not. It's a different brand, but it's also not Malignant's brand quite.
No.
Malignant was definitely like a tribute to like Italian giallo gore movies. And ultimately, without giving away too much, it kind of had a wild slasher introduction of its own.
This feels more akin to, like, Dead Silence or...
Right, which was, like, for those who don't know, that was James Wan's first movie, even before Saw, or, like, you know, certainly before Insidious and stuff. But he does have... You were talking about this earlier, Nick. He's got his more serious movies, sort of horror movies, like The Conjuring and Insidious, that play pretty straight, like, jump scares, but pretty strong stories and stuff. And... This one looks more out of the gate, over the top, like Malignant was.
He definitely likes
like
to play...
Like, it's his other speed.
He likes to play in different genres, because you got to remember, he does the Aquaman movies, too.
It's true.
So
this looks like what I would think of as kind of a thrill ride horror movie. There's going to be a lot of jump scares. And I know, like, James Wan likes weird twisty turns and endings.
There's going
to
be...
So I suspect there's something that we are not seeing here that's going to be some fun...
Multiple
balls-to-the-wall crazy thing at the end. I thought it looked like a lot of fun. I think the doll looks has a good look to it. It has an uncanny valley thing that's weird. At one point, it's racing around like a spider.
Yeah.
And
doing, like, a full-on dance at some point.
Yeah, well, in the same way that you can, like, take any CG model and be like, oh, I'm going to map a breakdancing routine onto it or whatever, and it'll do it. The doll was doing that stuff. Yes. And it was weird and creepy.
Yep.
And Randy's going to go see it when we tell him it's fun.
No, I'm not.
He is.
Totally is.
All right, let's take a break, and then we'll come back and talk about comics, and I'm not going to watch that movie. We are talking Comics League of Wednesday, October 12th, and there's some pretty notable graphic novels and a bunch of new number ones this week.
Yeah. Yeah. It is an overall pretty large week, as I recall.
So DC has their Halloween special, Terrors Through Time.
Oh, yeah. I forgot to grab that one.
Which I believe, I actually was confused when I was making the sign for it, and I thought it was just like oh, just some time travel stories from DC, but it's their Halloween thing. It just jumps around to different eras. Yep. Like, there's a 1940s, was it JSA type
there's
era
JSA
story?
JSA story, there's an Etrigan story, there's a Green Lantern, Swamp Thing, Phantom Stranger,
yep.
And then a Batman and Dead Man. With art by Kelly Jones.
Yeah, Kelly Jones, who, as far back, I think he did his Dead Man series in, like, 94 or something like that. It's been a while.
He was a big 90s Batman guy, though, too.
He did the covers for Batman Nightfall. He drew Batman getting his back broken by Bane.
It's true.
And he is a weird artist, but he, like, Dead Man is, like, his muse.
Yeah.
When he draws him, it's cool. He's like this elongated skeleton with, like, 800 ribs. Actually, that's true of every character.
You can tell Kelly Jones by how many extra ribs they've had. Yes,
but he also his hip bones and stuff are all poking out. Usually, Dead Man traditionally kind of looked like a lean, but very muscular acrobat.
Yep.
But then when Kelly Jones did him, he was almost more like a skeleton with clothes on.
Gaunt ghost.
Yeah, and it's a good look.
It is
a good look.
There's also a new Batman and Scooby-Doo Mysteries.
Yep.
For those of you who liked the Batman and Scooby-Doo Mysteries miniseries.
Weird as it seems, Batman and Scooby-Doo seem to go together well.
This also features the Knight and the Squire, I see.
Oh, wow, the English Batman and Robin.
But it is like the 60s Knight and Squire. Like, they look very
They
very
did it
old.
In, like, the style of 60s Scooby-Doo.
Yep.
Yeah.
And, there's another Batman villain in there I'm kind of surprised to see. Anyway.
Bane breaks the back of Shaggy.
Zoinks!
I'm broken, man.
There's a new Batman Incorporated series by Ed Brisson that takes Ghostmaker, the sort of anti-hero that James Tynion introduced.
Yep.
And he is now, like, running the corporate Batman Incorporated thing.
Yep. For people who didn't, like, read it during Grant Morrison's run, that it was like an old Silver Age concept of, like, an international team of Batmans.
Yep.
Batman of Mexico, Batman of Spain, Batman of England, and all that stuff.
Men of Bats.
And
of Bats.
They were all ideas that existed already from the Silver Age, but kind of got a rethink, a somewhat more serious rethink, but still kind of, I guess, I'm going to say having fun with the international thing. I don't know that they're all 100% respectful of the countries they come from, but they're all cool. That's a cool band. I like them.
I like Knight and Squire.
I like Knight and Squire. I like the Native American one, Man of Bats, you mentioned.
Yep.
I know there's some other ones. What's the French Batman? What's his deal?
Le Batman.
Sure.
I don't know.
Le Big Mac.
Le Big Mac. Marvel, in a time for the release of the new Wakanda Forever movie, has a Wakanda series.
Uh-huh. It's an ongoing or miniseries kind of thing?
I believe it's an ongoing.
Okay.
It's got two stories. The lead story is about Shuri, and it is... I guess in the Black Panther story that's going currently, Black Panther himself has been
exiled.
He's been exiled from Wakanda. There's a parliamentary democracy that's going on, but he is no longer king because there's political secrets.
Yep, and a new foe has set up shop in Wakanda.
Yep, yep.
Which is
and
this is
there's
fun.
An interesting foe who makes their way in here.
Why is it funny?
It's
you'd have to look at it.
Okay,
yeah.
But the lead story is focused on Shuri. And sort of what her powers are in the regular Marvel universe, and then there's a backup story that is the history of the Black Panthers by Austin local writer Evan Narcisse. Very cool. And he shows us the sort of early age Black Panther.
I thought the art on that was particularly really cool. Good.
Yeah.
So that's sort of a history of Wakanda, Black Panther, along with a modern day story.
Yeah.
And then the flip side of that is they did a Namor the Submariner series. This does not turn Namor into the sort of Mayan influenced TV version or movie version that we've seen.
Right. We don't know if that could be in the cards or not down the road, but at the moment it's pretty classic Marvel Namor, but it is in a future setting.
But mm-hmm. rather, this is a story of a sort of post apocalyptic Earth that has had the dual problems of environmental collapse and a Kree invasion, and so there are no superheroes left, and Namor is forced to come to the surface world and deal with their crap, because now that's everything's underwater.
I'm sure that's improved his always bad mood.
Yep. It's like an older Namor, too. He's like old. He's got the Reed Richards Grey Temples.
That's a fun hook. I like that as a hook. Namor's a character I primarily like in supporting roles, but I'll give this a try.
We have a bunch of Star Wars this week. In addition to the regular book, there is a new Star Wars The High Republic, number one. Nick, you read this one, didn't you?
Yeah, I enjoyed it. Basically, I don't know exactly, because I didn't read the last series, but this one picks up on a new character coming to the planet of Jedha, which we will remember from Rogue One that got destroyed.
That was their test fire planet?
Yeah, test fire planet, but this is kind of explaining Jedha in kind of a... really interesting. It's like the place everyone comes. It's like a religious experience, not just for
make a pilgrimage.
Yeah, you make a pilgrimage to Jedha, and it's just a cool notion about.
Was Jedha, by the way, was that where Saw Gerrera's people were, or was that where the end of the movie was?
That was where Saw was.
Okay,
and
the whole planet didn't get blown up. It just got a really bad black eye.
Well, that city got blown up completely.
Yeah. Hey, you know that's fine. Planet's fine. The planet's fine.
Sure. But it's about a new Jedi coming into that area as sort of a mediator and instantly getting in over his head. Okay. I actually thought it was a really good first issue, exploring a place that I thought could use some more exploration, honestly.
Yeah, that place has kyber crystals, right?
Yeah.
One of its big things. Yep. I like the idea of a place that the Jedi pilgrimage place.
Then we've got Star Wars Visions, number one. This is a new miniseries that picks up on the story from Star Wars Visions, The Ronin, which was like...
That was like the anime that they did of Star Wars, anime shorts, right?
Yep, yes. Yep.
This is the Sith Ronin and his droid, and this is a story... This is a prequel to that, I believe, right?
I don't know if it's a prequel or not, but it's just another tale of him wandering around, and he runs afoul of another character that is... very similar, but different as
yep.
well.
Yep.
And sort the conversation he has with him over the course of a night.
Yeah, I enjoyed it. Is this just a one shot?
I don't know.
I was like, there's no.
I was sort of wondering if each issue of this would just tie into one of the respective episodes.
That's possible.
The funny thing is, like, I guess the back is just saying what other stuff's available now, but like, there's no other, like, here, check out number two in a month. I'm like, it just looks like a number one.
It's weird to do a comic that is not in some way clear as to what to expect next. Just kind of slightly shoddy marketing.
Well, from what I understood, I thought there was going to be a novel about this the same character that this comic picks up. So I'm hoping they continue this on in comic book form as well, because I think it's an interesting setting, and the art is just a blast.
It's really, really nice, yeah.
It's black and white, right?
Yeah, with, of course, hints of, like, red and right. a couple of other colors. But, yeah, it's Lone Wolf and Cubbish, and
It has that art that looks like the kind of like heightened but real quasi realistic art you expect from like certain samurai manga.
Yeah,
that Lone Wolf and Cub, and man, what's that other one that was big? I don't know, 20 years ago. Dark Horse put it out. I can't say it.
Berserk?
Nah, it's specifically a samurai one. Berserk is like medieval
Vagabond?
Stuff.
Vagabond?
No? Maybe.
Vagabond was Viz, though.
It might have been Viz. Anyway, there's a certain sort of realistic style of art, and it's that style. If seen Star Wars Visions, that episode, it's the first one.
Yep.
And
Blade of the Immortal.
Looks cool.
Blade of the Immortal. That's what it is.
That was it.
All right.
Anyway. Well done, sir.
Yep. You know how I love manga.
Did you Google it?
I did not. I just sat. I Googled my head.
Oh.
We have so much information rallying around.
Yes, exactly.
A weirdly high amount of mine relates to Simon Williams' Wonder Man.
Yeah. There is a new book from the writers of The Beauty, the image book Beauty, called The Approach, that looks like it is a... Did they ever say exactly where it is? It's a small town, and maybe... I feel like it's like Canada or something.
I was going to say, I felt like Alaska or Canada or somewhere
It's definitely somewhere snowy and remote. So Canada or Alaska are one of those. But basically... It centers on the people who work at this airport. They get a call during a big snowstorm. There's a plane coming in that's going to have to be parked there. It's all about that. And then a small plane, unannounced, shows up and has someone on board. But that thing may have the person on board may have a secret.
Yes.
There's a little bit of the thing kind of set up here. Like they're setting up a bunch of people who are like all isolated, and maybe there's going to be a monster. It's a good first issue.
Yeah, it is.
It's got nice paranoia, nice art.
Another good spooky spooky comic to read before the holidays.
Image has a book called Hitomi. This is written by H.S. Tock and art by Isabella Mazzanti. I don't know either of those names, but it's very pretty.
It is.
A young woman trekking through, climbing up this mountain to consult with a monk. She's trying to get somebody who, what is it? Like, is it one of those kind of raised her village as a kid or something?
Yeah.
And killed her parents.
And is this, and I'm correct, this is like a black samurai that she is the person she's after. And I think it's one of those that it's like there may be more to the story than she knows that she will learn as she goes along. Because we see this guy later on and he's like traveling around, and I don't think he seems like he's particularly monstrous. He does lose in a sumo match that he's in, though.
It's true.
The art is exceptionally nice, too. So I would say if you have any of that samurai fondness, you might want to check this one out. Hitomi.
Yep. From the creators of, they worked on Deadpool, Jerry Duggan, Brian Posehn, Scott Kalish. Last year they did earlier this year, I think, called The Secret History of the War on Weed.
Yep.
It was like a big action spoof parody. This is that character continues. They're sort of over-the-top action hero in a thing called Halloween Party. This is their Halloween-themed.
I believe from the solicit I read, it was kind of like they wanted to sort of spoof the real terrors of the world.
Yep.
You know, I'm sure it is like environmental stuff and Trumpism and stuff. Or maybe, I don't know, is that the thing?
Well, I see in here definitely a riff on maybe on It, because there's a scary clown.
Oh, okay.
A riff on E.T., it's that kind of thing. If you need a sort of Halloween parody thing, it's also Scotch McTiernan. I don't know who that is. Is that John McTiernan's son? Could be.
Probably. We've eliminated the impossible. Whatever's left must be the truth.
I don't know. There's a name attached to it that I don't recognize.
All
right. We also
got... Randy knows every single person in the industry.
I do. I know everyone. There is another volume of Reckless, the Ed Brubaker, Sean Phillips crime series that I have been loving, called Follow Me Down. This is the only one I've not had a chance to read in advance, so I'm going in blind, but I've been really, really enjoying these.
Yep, that's his somewhat Rockford Files-inspired recurring private investigator.
Yeah. We've got The Closet, which is a James Tynion...
psychological horror.
Yeah.
Short he did. It was a 3-issue miniseries. We've talked about it in past episodes.
Yep.
Had the kid who had the weird vision of like an alien-like creature. And I say alien like the gray aliens.
Yep.
Yeah.
Like lurking in his closet.
With creepy teeth.
Yep. And then there was some like sort of intense, I'm going to say, character stuff about his, I don't know, his dad, who was like this really not great guy who was not able to sort of be very present mentally for him, for his wife, who'd had an affair, and yet only felt sorry for himself. But the way they drew it out was kind of compelling. Like, I was just like, man, this is kind of difficult to read because this guy is such a kind of disaster. But it's sort of, I guess I'd compare it to something like The Babadook as one of those horror things where there's already kind of a bad family situation going on even before weird spooky stuff interjects into it. Anyway, and also good art.
Then we got the new volume of Something's Killing the Children.
Yep.
Volume 5. We have a Stranger Things omnibus that collects, I think, the first 3 graphic novels into one.
Yeah, those Stranger Things, with the penultimate season, I guess, is what came out. But people got hyped for it, and although these have been around before, they definitely... people had really started picking them up now that I guess there's a decent little library of them.
Yep.
And it's that much easier to get them in this big volume.
Indeed.
So if you got Stranger Things Mania, if you want to know some side stories and lost stories of certain characters, check it out.
And then we've got Lore Olympus Volume 3, sort of hot on the heels of Volume 2, which I feel is about a few months.
Yep. Yep. Lore Olympus, the big web comic, the spicy tales of the Greek gods after dark.
Yeah, but it's especially focused on
Persephone
and, yeah, and Hades.
Yep. Yeah, they're sort of an unlikely romance, and but yeah, there's almost, it's kind of just from what I've read of it, always sort of machinations and power plays and gaslighting and all this other stuff, Greek god stuff, but again, framed as if it was all kind of going down like at nightclubs and parties and things like that.
Interesting. And then we've got issue 2 of Batman versus Robin, the latest issue of Superman Son of Kal-El, and a new issue of Chip Zdarsky's Daredevil, also
the Superman Son of Kal-El is kind of notable because Superman, that the classic Clark Kent Superman, has been sort of exiled in space for like a year or two while his son does a damn good job in his stead.
Yep.
And here they are reunited.
Yep.
And it's some really good scenes. But I also loved, have you read it, Randy?
Yes.
I loved his interaction with Luther.
Yeah.
There's, I mean, I'm just saying this bit, it's early on anyway. Luther, he's in one of his swole mode.
Yeah.
And he's like lifting weights and stuff like that. And Superman just comes up and just holds this big barbell thing, and he's like, you need a spotter. And Luther gets up angrily, and he's like, you know, your father had the decency to stand outside my window when he was haranguing me.
Yeah.
Like, but as Jonathan points out, he's not his dad. He does stuff his own way.
That's right. Then he lasers his head off.
Yes.
There was also a second issue of Star Trek Lower Decks, which I thought was really, really fun.
Yep. Y'all, Randy, I know you have rather fully warmed up, I'd say, to the to Lower Decks as it's going through second season.
Yep, third season.
Nick, you've been kind of getting a little bit of like maybe the vibe to watch it again.
Yeah, well,
I know that
also,
it's one that I can't quite plug into. It's just the style of humor just isn't for me.
I think Star Trek animation, I kind of had to warm to a little bit.
Sure, it's not usually its thing.
No, and especially after I did finish watching the entirety of Prodigy.
Yeah,
and I thought Prodigy was fantastic for what it was.
We totally forgot to talk about Star Trek trailers.
I was just thinking the same thing. Yeah. We forgot there's trailers for Discovery, Prodigy, and Picard.
Yeah, we'll talk about that next week.
Next week.
But I really enjoyed Prodigy, so I kind of want to check back in Lower Decks. I know it's an entirely different thing. Because,
sure.
It's Rick and Morty-esque.
But what you're saying is that you have wrapped your head a little bit around the idea of playing ball with Star Trek in the cartoon worlds.
Exactly.
Yeah. All right. That'll do it for comics for this week. We're going to take a break, and then we're going to talk about a couple TV shows and a couple of podcasts. All right, so first of all, we're going to talk about Werewolf by Night.
Yep.
So we will offer a spoiler warning. If you've not seen it, why haven't you seen it? Go see it. Even Dave's seen it.
Yeah, and you know, we had somebody in yesterday, I believe, Randy, who was like, oh, what even is Werewolf by Night? And I suppose, like, this is not promoted with the weight of a full Marvel movie, even though it is like an hour-long Marvel special. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
on Disney.
Special presentation.
On Disney Plus, yeah. But, like, I know that a lot of our customers have known about it because, of course, it's been promoted in MCU circles. But yet, just in the off chance you don't know, it's like a horror special little mini-movie.
Yep.
Mostly black and white.
And taking a very, really very obscure Marvel horror property from the 70s and 80s, finding the MCU incarnation of it.
And having a director that is really a composer.
He's Michael Giacchino, who... did he create the Avengers theme? We know.
Yeah. No, that's Alan Silvestri.
Okay, yeah, okay. But he's done some MCU work.
Yeah,
he's done some amazing work on
Multiverse of Madness.
The TV show Lost. He did what is it? Probably did do Alias, but there was
he did
the great Star Trek theme in the, you know, almost like whatever you think about the movie set in the Kelvin universe. Mm-hmm. With Chris Pine and all that, like he came up with like a really strong original Star Trek theme that wasn't just nostalgia for pre-existing music.
Yep. He's literally one of the best composers in the business.
He's incredible.
Yep, he's a For me, he's probably in the top five right now. I don't know. He's not in my top three, but he's up there.
It's also it's a little strange that a composer would become a director. I don't know if that's ever happened.
I think probably most people would be somewhat right to be nervous about that.
Yep.
But what we are going about to tell you is that we all liked it.
Yeah. Oh, liked quite a bit. Yeah.
Like to love, I think. There were moments in there that I just outright loved. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and you know what? I've seen that as a consensus, just kind of among my friend circles, which would normally, you know, even though, yeah, I'm in the nerdy community, but normally there's nerds are opinionated. I don't know if you've ever seen this before.
No.
But some of them would be like, it's trash or whatever, but everybody's been like, oh, that God, was super fun.
Oh, God, it's black and white. I won't watch this crap.
I didn't see a single person mention that.
No, I didn't either.
So visually, it is an homage to old Universal monster movies. Mm. And it has a kind of a neat hook in it, which is to take an obscure Marvel Monster Hunter character, like, and I'm talking like hunting like classic monsters like werewolves and vampires and stuff, Ulysses Bloodstone.
Yep.
And he has this sort of magical stone, I guess. Is that what
which
it is?
Which extends his life, gives him like speed and strength. And
yeah.
Everything.
And he has died, and so it's essentially kind of up to the next... it's going to be legacy passed on, but it has to be somebody who fulfills what he thinks is like being a good monster hunter.
It was supposed to go to Elsa, but she
he has a wayward daughter.
Basically said F you and went off on her own to do things.
They don't say a whole lot about it, but it seems like she didn't want in on the crazy family drama.
Correct.
Yeah.
Which
makes sense because her like stepmom or mom or whoever that person is seems like a crazy person.
Just a monster.
She's pretty crazy.
But when it begins, what we're at like a kind of a weird
Hunter's Lodge
thing, where the best monster hunters of the world, kind of an eccentric collection of people from different countries and just weird different looks, and they even talk about sometimes having like you know a certain look as to kind of like. Build up who they are.
Yeah.
They are about to go on some sort of hunt, which will, and the winner of that hunt, if you kill the creature and survive against the other hunters, you get the Bloodstone. Pretty simple premise.
Yep.
But there's some intrigue within that, and the point of view character is, what's his?
Gael Garcia Bernal.
Yep, a.k.a. Jack.
Jack Russell.
Russell? Did they say his name at any point during the last name?
They called him Jack. I don't think Jack Russell.
Yes, for those who have read the comic, though, yes, the Werewolf by Night's name is Jack Russell.
Yeah, he's a terrier.
But somewhat he has been rethought there. I believe he was generic, like, white college guy back in the day. Yeah. And Marvel is smartly not making everybody a generic white guy, even if that's who they began as. Because, Werewolf by Night, although a fun comic, and my brother had some of these in the 70s and 80s, and I read some of them, and had art from Mike Ploog, who did, like, Hollywood work on The Thing and stuff like that. Like, he's a great, really good artist. But the comic was only ever okay. And so it was ripe for a rethink. And so, yes, we've got this guy in there, and we don't know anybody's real... Well, we know most of their motives are just, I want that Bloodstone.
Yep. He has a different motivation entirely.
And I guess we're going to spoil it.
We're spoiling it, yeah.
The creature they're hunting is a truly obscure Marvel reference that everybody has now been let in on.
Man-Thing.
Man-Thing, yes.
Is he obscure? I mean,
absolutely.
He's pretty obscure. I mean, it's C or D-list Man-Thing.
You could be a fan of Marvel comics, it's certainly in the present era, and have never heard of him.
But is he basically on the level of, like, Rocket Raccoon? Because Rocket Raccoon
was not before he became big.
Yes. Before he became big.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah, I would say so.
And I feel like he's going to rocket to that same kind of thing.
I don't know about that.
Well, yeah, like...
He'll be showing up again.
He doesn't talk a lot, but he will be showing up again.
Yeah.
And in the comics, he doesn't really talk much. He is like a muck monster, like the Swamp Thing, but he is usually more like they don't sometimes make out that he's almost even sentient.
Yeah, he's more planty.
He's drawn to like trauma and dark events, and he does sort of in his way help. But it's like being helped by like this weird force of nature.
Yeah,
helping you mean burning people alive.
Yes, because as anybody in the comics knows, all who know fear burn at the Man-Thing's touch. Yes, literally, if he touches you, even though he's a swamp monster, you will like burst into flame.
Yep.
Unless you're like freaking Daredevil.
I was gonna say Jack touched him. He didn't. He didn't.
Right.
Burn
to
death.
They're buddies. They're buddies.
And they don't get exactly deeply into his lore. Here he is. You know probably because the comic lore is like. From Steve Gerber and all the other the big psychedelic writers of the 70s had a hand in him at some point. And he's got a convoluted origin, and sometimes he's this, and sometimes he's that. So, in this, though, he's just a monster with, you don't know a lot about it, who's been turned loose.
Yep.
He is, I don't think they ever name him other than how he is known to the lead guy, who just calls him Ted.
Yeah.
Which is the name of the, I guess, his alter ego.
Ted
before
Salas he, is yep. his alter ego.
And what you find is that Jack is there not to hunt him, but to free his friend who's been taken in by this.
He final does, time. He's done
He's clearly done it before, yeah. And he thinks things are safe from him becoming a werewolf because it's five nights to, like, the full moon.
Yep. Yep.
That does not prove to be the case. Yep. There's magic stuff involved.
Yep.
And the story, by and large, follows the hunt. An uneasy alliance with Elsa Bloodstone, mm-hmm. That black sheep of the family. Yep. And a bunch of fun, colorful hunters.
Yes.
Yeah.
Who's the? Is it Scottish?
He's Scottish. Wearing a kilt.
Yeah. This dude is like a big old like Scottish biker Highlander man, yeah. and he's yeah. like, I'm coming for that bloodstone.
Yep.
I liked
his interaction with Jack at the beginning about I like your whole look.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And,
yeah. The characters the
I think it was great that they made it like an hour long, an energetic hour.
Yeah.
The other hunters were really interesting, were fun. The settings and showing the monsters who clearly are like old Marvel monsters.
Yeah. Yeah, they have like heads mounted on the wall.
That was cool. The way they used the werewolf I thought was really cool.
Sure. What I thought was kind of fascinating is that as originally depicted in the comics in like the 70s, he kind of looked like the classic werewolf like from like the old Universal movies, you know,
green pants,
like a dude with a kind of wolfish type face and furry body. But yeah, he had like pants and a shirt on and stuff like that. Later in the comics, artists like Bill Sienkiewicz would make him more inhuman looking, but they kind of went classic with this, which fit the black and white motif.
Well, they didn't do any like CGI or anything.
I was wondering if they how much a CG assist or anything.
Apparently,
there was in
that. They did. All like he actually had the fur and like make full on makeup.
Like it. Yeah,
and
it looked. He has a physical presence.
I know they really wanted to do practical
and they
effects.
Did wire work for a lot of the jumping
and,
around.
And you know what's
stuff.
Funny is like you can kind of tell, but it's perfect for it. It's good. It like feels like it's got a little bit of a foot in sort of like older special effects.
Yeah,
but he does do like when he starts wrecking dudes. It's not like it's gory, but you will see some blood spraying around.
It's pretty gory.
I feel like it's not, actually. I feel like it feels gory.
But black and white lets it be.
At no point
blood,
did I ever see somebody get like eviscerated
right.
or anything like that.
You did see
like
somebody
that.
Get a arrow shoved up their into their skull.
It's true. It's true. Yep. That was arguably the goriest thing. And it was a bad person, though.
It was. I'm just saying, it's more violent than we've seen in the MCU prior.
Early on, I from one of the trailers I had seen, or maybe from the descriptions, I think someone had said, oh, that's part Universal Monsters, part Grindhouse. It's much more Universal Monsters.
Yeah.
It's a little edgier in the violence, and even then, they usually, because it's in black and white and there's a lot of shadows and stuff, you don't see too much. But yeah, if you got the young kids... It's worth knowing that there's a bit more violence in this than some of the others.
I also think
like a kid, by the way, would have a lot of fun with this.
Oh, yeah, the camera work in the black and white actually works to its advantage in a lot of ways because even the visual effects that they do use, like with Man-Thing, they are, I feel like, are enhanced by it as opposed to detracting from it. And I don't know. I think there are a lot. Gian Chino did a great job.
Honestly, kids who, if you're a parent or something who might have like some love for old school horror movies, like the Universal Monster movies and stuff like that, this would be a great way to kind of get a kid somewhat on board that tone.
Yeah.
Is just show it to them. That's fun. Okay, let's watch Frankenstein and stuff like that.
Well, I want them to continue these special presentations.
I would love to see more of this world.
Well, I know about everybody I know who saw it has said that same thing, and I would agree too.
I know we're getting one, the Guardians of the Galaxy, the Christmas
the holiday special.
You know what's fascinating? At this point, early on, they had to do like an Iron Man. So much justification for like how this suit works.
Yep.
Make sure audiences are on board. Even when they did Guardians of the Galaxy, yes, there was some crazy stuff in there, but it was a big gamble. And now they've got, like, magic users, standard thing.
I was going to say, remember when Thor showed up and originally, like, they had to explain that, no, they're not the gods, they're aliens who are basically like the gods.
Now we're just like, okay,
and now
whatever.
They're just like, no, they're the gods, here's the Bloodstone.
Right, and
there's
just like,
werewolf.
Oh yeah, there's monsters, there's, like, monster hunters and just some kind of traditional monsters. And we're not going to say... Do the monsters come from the Eternals? Oh, are the monsters super science? It's just monsters.
Yeah.
It's basically, it caught up with the comics.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm so happy about that.
It's great. Next up is Mike Flanagan's new Netflix show. It's based on a YA novel, or maybe a series of YA novels.
I think it's just a one-off.
Right? Yeah, it was actually just a one-off novel called Midnight Club.
Okay. Midnight Club is the name of the show. Dave, how much of this have you seen?
One episode.
Nick and I have seen all 10.
Yep. now, just a real quick recap. Mike Flanagan, you probably know him best from a bunch of very successful Netflix horror series, Haunting of Hill House, Haunting of Bly Manor, Midnight Mass.
Yep, called the Flaniverse now.
Really?
Yeah. If you look on Netflix, it says part of the Flaniverse.
Yeah. I don't know that's real cool, but
it's
sure.
Not cool.
I don't know. If you're Mike Flanagan and you see that on Netflix, that's kind of
cool. It's cool for Mike Flanagan, but what a terrible name, the Flaniverse.
So,
it sounds like the Flaniverse.
Yeah. It's a delightful universe.
Into the Flaniverse.
You never know. He might be a big fan of Flan.
Take me there, Doctor Strange. Now, like, people who've watched those specials know that, or even at Flanagan's other horror movies, he's mainly a horror guy, very influenced by Stephen King, and he's always got this kind of very, I guess, say humanistic spin on it.
This is a very Stephen King-esque take.
Yeah, so the stories are about these kids who have, like, terminal illnesses.
Yep.
And a somewhat unusual sort of mansion-like kind of house where they can go as, like, a hospice.
Yep.
So there is a very serious underpinning to this.
Yeah.
And yet there's also, like, raunchy humor, kids dropping the F-bomb, kids being defiant about their situation.
Kids are kids.
These are teenagers, and they go down to the basement. They're not supposed to be out of their rooms at night. There's only one night nurse. There's only paying that much attention. So they go in at midnight. They drink some wine.
Yep.
Some bootleg wine that they've gotten, and they tell scary stories at the Midnight Club. Now, it also seems there may be like a haunting or something going on.
Yep. As soon as the girl who's the lead arrives, and by the way, the opening sequence, the opening like 10 minutes or so, is where we see her go from like rather sort of promising college life approaching her.
Yep.
She sneaks out to kind of her first party and stuff like that, to finding out she's basically got a kind of cancer, right?
Yep.
And it's very serious, and then there's kind of a rapidly we see if some months pass and things are not looking good.
Well, there are a handful of characters. Is there seven or eight of them, I think? I can't remember exactly.
Sounds about right.
All of them are good. Yeah. All of them are developed really well over the course. I mean, Flanagan does great stuff with character work always. And as it goes on, they do a really good thing. But one of the things I really liked about this, and you don't get sort of a strong sense of it in the first episode, I think, but they each have their stories they're telling. They take turns telling stories. And so you get a variety of different stories with this cast. So it's almost an anthology within a series.
Interesting.
Like, they are telling... There's an ongoing serial killer ghost story that's told. There's a story about sort of witches that is told. There's a ghost story. There's all kinds of different tales that are told with these characters, and they're telling stories that are about themselves.
Yeah.
But they're putting themselves in this weird supernatural stuff. It's a really interesting framework, and the character work is so good.
I mean, and that's what Flanagan's known for. Yeah. What I was going to say is, when the girl arrives at the place, she has these eerie visions of, like, kind of creepy, ghoulish figures, ghost-like stuff.
Yeah.
Serena has read the book it's based on, and I think she said the book was very, kind of specifically had no real supernatural stuff.
Yeah.
Maybe, like, hints about it, without saying too much, how supernaturally is this?
I don't want to say.
Yeah,
okay,
I'm not gonna say.
That's fine. The first episode also has a little bit of meta stuff where Flanagan, who is like always, I guess I'd say, done a good mixture in his stories of different balance, but of like classic eerie slow burn stuff and jump scares. Not afraid of the jump scare. Although I actually read this interview thing where he said he doesn't really like them,
but he does in everything he's done.
He does, but there's not as many in, say, Bly Manor.
Yeah,
but there's some very, like, what do you call it? Haunting of Hill House had one of those mother of all jump scares.
Yeah,
one is the one I'm thinking of.
But this one, the opening story, the first story that's being told, someone does like 30, 40 jump scares in a minute.
And
they sort of like they're joking about it, and then they do a cat jump scare, and like, no, the cat jump scare comes before the actual scares. What are you doing?
Yeah, the kids are like busting on her for doing it.
Yeah.
They're like, what the fuck is this? and they're like talking about how cheap it is. But it is like a meta joke about kind of his own movies and stuff. Anyway, yeah, it's intriguing, and I just need to find the time to watch some more of them.
Yeah, I'll also say, without saying too much, that as you get in, that like it's very emotional. Like there's episodes like 7 and 8, especially, are like a little gut punch. They're really, really good.
And I'll also say that Heather Langenkamp does a really good job.
Oh, yeah. I'm playing the Doctor, and then playing a bunch of other adult.
Yeah,
roles.
She plays various roles.
If you're not a horror nerd, you may not recognize the name, but Heather Langenkamp was the original final girl in Nightmare on Elm Street.
Yeah,
and has been recurred in them throughout.
She's really great here. So the other thing we were going to talk about, Dave, you and I, you got turned onto this by, I forget who
our mutual friend Dave Lamplug.
Yeah, who is a film guy, and there's a podcast called Video Archives that is hosted by Quentin Tarantino and his producer buddy Roger Avery.
Yep,
they
both used
they both used to work at this place, the Video Archives, that was a VHS shop in its heyday.
Yeah, kind of like an 80s and 90s trendy video place where Tarantino, already kind of a super film nerd, would recommend movies to people, watch cult movies, talk about movies all day and stuff like that. And I think they clearly, now that they're in their, 50s, 60s?
60s.
Are like, oh, you know what would be fun? To do that again.
Well, it's interesting, cause Tarantino talks about, Video Archives closed, obviously. There's not a lot of independent video stores left.
Right. So he bought it.
He bought it, and, apparently it takes place in part of his house, is the Video Archives.
He bought all the shelving units and stuff
everything.
Like that.
Because Roger Avery sort of teased him about it. He's like, I felt like I came into the Video Archives store when I came.
And Tarantino is trying to be he's like, it's not like a shrine. The shelves came with it.
That's where they fit.
Yeah. And I will say this, I think, Tarantino kind of comes with a reputation as a person. Whatever you think of his films, you know that he is both, I would say, very knowledgeable about film. He loves film, and you can feel that. But he's also kind of an annoying dude that grates on some people, and I get that.
A little egotistical.
A little egotistical, and I feel like...
I think he's mellowed.
He has mellowed a bit. It's not that he's none of those things. It's still basically Tarantino. But I found out recently, because I listened to an interview on Mark Maron's show, that he has a kid now.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, oh, it seems like that has maybe imparted a certain level of maturity I never expected to see. And he just seems a little more chill about it. Because Roger Avery is, I would say, a less discerning critic.
Yeah.
He's very knowledgeable. And he doesn't get as talked over as I worried he might be.
He used to be mean.
He said when he was a kid, Tarantino's like, you either thought it was the best thing in the world or total shit.
Well, he used to keep basically a ledger of all the movies that come out each year that he would see. He would write a review of it.
Roger Avery?
Yeah, Roger Avery. And he goes back and looks at them, and he was very mean.
How do you know about this, Nick? You're not saying he does it for the podcast. You're saying you just knew this.
Yeah, okay. Well, no. Tarantino and Avery have popped up on a podcast I listen to called The Big Picture. Tarantino's done multiple episodes. He's friends with the host, and he just talked about film.
It's kind of funny that Tarantino should go and kind of get into podcasting.
Yeah.
I mean, it kind of makes sense. It's the medium.
He's a film nerd.
It's a perfect outlet for a jabberjaw.
Yeah. And plus...
Randy.
get together a couple of other film nerds. I mean, they just sit around and talk bullshit for 2 hours.
Sure. What they do, though, in this is they take kind of cultish movies. It had to be something that they literally have the VHS tape of that they could have rented back in the day. Yeah. So you're not going to find movies from the 2000s here. And they discuss the highs and lows, which usually if they're talking about something, there's some appeal to it for them.
Yeah, they'll be enthusing about it.
Yes. Then they also bring in Roger Avery's 20-something daughter, Gala.
Yep.
And she kind of provides a little bit of, hey, let me throw some perspective that's not old man perspective.
But also she's like well, here's how you can find these movies now.
She's the announcer.
The job they give her is hey, we're going to watch these two movies, see if you can find them.
Right.
And so she comes on and tells, whether it's streaming or whether you can buy it on DVD or something like that.
So it could be on YouTube.
Yeah.
If you can get it on eBay, how much they paid for it. There's just a little bit of interesting behind-the-scenes stuff like that. But the beating heart of it is him and Roger Avery jabbering about movies in some very entertaining ways.
And also, there's nostalgia to it. Like, they both talk about when they saw movies and going to theaters and the stars and that kind of thing.
I'll give you the quick example. The first movie they talk about is John Carpenter's first movie, which was a student movie turned feature once it got a little bit of budget, called Dark Star.
Now, I thought this was a John Carpenter movie, but he's directed. But the story is written by, and his stars, the guy... Dan O'Bannon, who wrote Alien.
Right.
And... it is very clear to me, having never seen Dark Star, that this is more of a Dan O'Bannon joint than it is a Carpenter joint.
I think that's true.
It's about working class guys in space.
Yeah, they're like clearing debris, and but there is like weird stuff.
They're dropping sentient bombs on unoccupied planets to make way for like hyperspace bypasses and stuff.
Yeah, so there's like think sort of a cynical bit of satire. There's an alien attack in it, and the alien is like a beach ball.
Yeah,
and because like they went from like zero budget to enough budget to film some special effects.
Yeah.
But it also, like, the two, Tarantino and Roger Avery enthuse just giddily over its handcrafted effects and, like, how the going into warp drive effect is, like, the same that it is in Star Wars. That they're like, there's no way that George Lucas didn't take it from this.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it came out in, what, like, 74, I think. And when they'd been working on it, like, since 71.
Yeah.
But, yeah, they talk about it. And I think, Randy, you and I had a similar experience, which is some of these movies. And, by the way, I've tried to watch Dark Star one time. John Carpenter fan number one, I couldn't do it.
Yeah.
It's too unpolished. The sort of counterculture humor, which Tarantino does talk about, like, being very off-putting to him when he saw it as a kid, it was off-putting to me as an adult, and yeah. I was just, like, not really into it. But hearing them talk about it is very entertaining.
So this is what, this to me, is fascinating to me. The first episode, and I've only heard the first episode, then one of the, like, I've just started the second one. But the first episode, they talk about Dark Star, which is a sci-fi comedy.
Yep.
And they talk about Cocaine Cowboys, which is a weird crime movie.
About, yeah, like a band, like they're like a rock band that's like smuggles drugs in a very specific scheme.
It seems like they're saying that basically the guy who's the lead, he's like, this guy clearly, this is his life. He was clearly a drug smuggler. Right.
And Andy Warhol is somehow in it.
Andy Warhol's a guest star. So in listening to both of these, I don't have the bad movie gene. I don't have the exploitation movie gene. I don't have the 70s movie gene, like none of that stuff. So I listen to this and I'm like, I have no interest in seeing either of these movies, but I am fascinated hearing these two dudes talk about it.
Yeah. And I think that is the general, like that's going to be my approach to the show. Although I did, after they, some of the other ones they reviewed included 80s, well, like one of the most derided Bond movies, Moonraker. And kind of an 80s cult movie, Firefox, Clint Eastwood's spy thriller with a big finale with a futuristic plane.
Have you seen Firefox?
Yes, I watched it as a kid.
I've never seen. I remember seeing the ads. It was on the back of comics.
Yep. All their descriptions.
Yes.
All their descriptions of watching it when they were younger is accurate, which is to say, it's for a kid watching it. The ads made it look like it was all futuristic plane action all the time.
But it's got to be super boring.
It's slow spy stuff as he slowly they take this guy who's got PTSD, Clint Eastwood, but who's a pilot and. And it's like he slowly makes his way through Russia with one contact after another and spy material that's like they sort of a Robert Ludlum type stuff.
Yeah.
And until he steals it. And like the last third of the movie is him getting it out of Russia, going to a refueling station, blowing up pursuit jets and stuff like that. That's what I was there for.
Yeah.
But they do the same thing where they're like, yeah, we're bored to tears as an adult. But as a kid, they're like, oh, we kind of like the spy stuff better.
Yeah, yeah.
And then there's some dodgy special effects from the otherwise great special effects guy, John Dykstra.
Well, I think it's interesting because they talk about the way movies are marketed and that didn't make any sense, that kind of thing. And
yeah. Honestly, it is fairly continually interesting observations from it.
Well, there's definitely a talk of movies and as fetishistic objects too. Like they specifically talk about the brand of the video, like who put this out on video,
even how much the tape weighs once in a while.
What the jacket says. They do the descriptions from the
like, is it an old clamshell box with art on it?
Yeah.
Does it have legible writing or has it kind of gotten illegible over time?
Yeah, Nick, this feels like something you should be totally into, given your video store background.
Oh yeah, no, I mean to check it out, but I know what they're talking. talking about.
Yeah. I believe you will find even more of interest than
they'll always say where whatever section they filed it in.
Yep.
Sometimes be like, I don't know why we put it in there or how it was a weirdly alphabetized or whatever.
And then they do these outtake ones. Like the main episodes are hour and a half, hour 45.
Yep.
They do these outtake ones where it's like Gala will just sort of do the bridging. It's just clearly it was a discussion they were having outside of the actual episode.
Yeah.
Because they did a mini episode, it's like 35 minutes, and she will like break into bridge, be like, well, they talked about this, and they talked about this actress, and so the loose theme of that one was like women in prison movies. It was like Caged Heat, not Caged Heat,
something like that.
Yeah, though. But this the Pam Grier, the first Pam Grier's first movie.
Right.
It's like a big
and Well, what was I going to say? Is they'll end up taking she kind of curates the little moments.
Yes.
Like, oh, this was an interesting 3-minute discussion. Oh, here's an interesting 5-minute discussion. Yep. And so, yeah, you don't need to hear the whole thing, but you get the highlight reel.
Yeah. Well, I remember specifically, she's like, everybody knows that he's a big Pam Grier fan, but not everybody knows he's a big fan of Roberta DaCosta or whatever her name was.
Yeah.
And here it is for about a few minutes talking about her.
Yeah.
And then they play the discussion, and it's really interesting. And yeah, it's a really good podcast. I feel like we maybe not be seeing the extent of the work that the Gala is doing on the editing stuff together to make it coherent. Yeah.
But I feel like it's kind of a fun, upbeat sort of thing.
It is.
That, you know, it's just like these guys put out a lot of energy about what they're into.
Yep. I was going to say, half the reason like Tarantino is so interesting to listen to is you could tell the genuine excitement he has for movies.
Yep.
And that
Roger Avery has that as well.
Yeah.
It's a slightly different, it's somewhat more, he's clearly of the two, he's the good cop, if I had to coin it like that, and Tarantino's the bad cop.
Yeah.
At one point when Roger Avery has a big love of campy Moonraker.
Yeah.
And it even sounds like, I infer from what he said, that he was dealing with maybe a little depression from the pandemic. And his daughter, Gala, who was, like, in film school and was watching it, like, on her monitor, he saw a really beautifully framed shot as he was walking by, and it, like, inspired him to want to watch it. He talks about a scene that made him cry in Moonraker, and every once in a while, Tarantino, you can kind of hear, he sighs heavily into the microphone, like, jeez.
Yeah, but then you get to, hopefully at some point Tarantino will go on and on about a Tony Scott film.
Is that one of his things?
He loves Tony Scott.
Oh, interesting. I mean, obviously he wrote at least one Tony Scott movie.
Yeah, but I think
two, I guess, because there was the submarine movie, and then also
True Romance. True Romance.
But Crimson Tide, he only did script doctor.
Yeah, he did script
that's
doctor.
Right, that's right.
But he loves his movies. I've seen him talk about Unstoppable?
Train
movie? Where he's like, the train is a monster. This is a horror film.
I finally watched Unstoppable a year ago, last year.
But it's really good.
It's a weird movie, though. It's
when did it come out?
It's right before Tony Scott died.
Yeah, it was like one of
they
his last
ones. They wouldn't be covering that because it's got to be from the video store.
But
Unstoppable is one of these things like, Tony Scott got really into the infrastructure of America in the deal.
A little bit.
Because it is all about like, how trains work. It is a very weird action movie.
But he also, like, it's a very watchable movie. I mean, Denzel Washington and Chris Pine do a really good job with that movie as well. And it's just a fun movie.
That is an interesting loadout. But yeah, I think if you despise Tarantino, don't watch it. If you're a film nerd of any stripe, though, and you don't despise Tarantino, maybe give it a shot.
Even still, I don't think this is very Tarantino-esque. Like, it's not.
It's true. It's not like you're not getting film Tarantino, like his actual movie Tarantino.
I've listened to 2.5 episodes, and not for once has the N-word come up. And that's very weird for Tarantino.
That's true. His excesses are not in evidence. And actually, every once in a while, he'll just be talking about stuff, and I was like, oh, he's being very clearly kind of more empathetic.
Yep.
He's talking to Roger Avery's young daughter and being chill with her and cool and listening to a young person's opinions that differ from his. Every once in a while, he does push back a little bit, but for the most part, he's being pretty mature.
Yeah.
Him talking about... I listened to an interview with him and him talking about what movie he was going to get his... It's his son, right?
Sure.
I don't know.
To watch. And I think they were watching Minions in 10-minute increments because that was the extent of
the
attention span. No. The child's attention span. No, he was very much... He wanted the child to experience movies in the way he did as sort of this loving environment and like...
The enveloping whole movie.
Yeah. And so, but, you know, he was also noting that the attention span of a 2-year-old is only going to go so far.
I'm just saying, if Tarantino wanted to record a director's commentary for Minions, I would watch that. I would watch Tarantino's thoughts on Minions. Absolutely.
I feel like I would listen to him talk about it. Yeah, I would too.
All right, well, that wraps it up for us this week. We'll be back next week with more. Until that time,
Yo, Joe!
Roguecast is a weekly podcast broadcast from Rogues Gallery Comics and Games in Round Rock, Texas. You can find us online on Facebook and at www.roguesgallerytx.com and email us comments or questions at roguesgallerytx@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.